Okay, my name is Daniel Schur. I'm the Associate Director of the Innovations for Successful Societies project, and I'm here with Dr. Peter Smith at Parliament in South Africa. Thanks very much for taking time out of your day to meet with me. I do appreciate it. I've sort of outlined the scope of the project, and I have a few questions for you. But before we do that, I wonder if you'd mind just giving a brief introduction to yourself and your involvement with Nkata and with
Fine. Well, first of all, thanks, Daniel. I'm not Dr. Smith. I'm plain Mister. No, my involvement goes back to the late 80s, 88. I started working with the party through a structure, an affiliated structure. And I stayed with the party from then until now. Initially as a researcher, then as a manager of an information center, then as a participant in the CADESA talks, and then I joined Parliament in 94 with the first elections and have been there since. So, I mean, fairly substantial period, but plenty of much longer record than myself. Sure. But, yeah, 20 years.
Okay, excellent. Can I just ask a quick general question? So when you have this moment in South African history when F.W. de Klerk unbans the ANC and the South African Communist Party and some other parties, what did you see as somebody who was involved with Nkata, what did you see the particular challenges or priorities for your movement at that point in time?
Well, you know, we had always been calling for the release of the political prisoners. So, you know, that was really a dream come true for everybody, ourselves included. Our call at the time was for an all-inclusive constitutional negotiations to commence virtually immediately. But, of course, there was a period of disagreement on the form that should take. And also on the participants and the ratios of one group to another, and also on the status of whatever would come out of it. At the end, the product was a bit of a compromise, I suppose. You had an interim constitution which came out of a process that we sort of would have been calling for, but then that constitution itself resulted in the election of a National Assembly, and which constituted itself also as a constitutional assembly, and then drafted a final constitution. So I think we were happy, we would have been happier with a once-off process where we agreed on a constitution, as opposed to a constitution which would provide a mechanism to create another constitution. Partly because the process would end up diluting some of the gains that one had made in the first round, which is precisely what happened, of course. But be that as it may. So, yeah, I think we were pretty fixated on moving into the next phase. But while we're in that process, of course, there are all sorts of things happening in the country that were running in tandem to calls for negotiations and agreements even on beginning negotiations. And I think the particular concern that we had, which was a valid concern, and it one that's somewhat problematic, was that although there was a process which was ostensibly a multi-party process, which all participants would deliberate on matters, we saw a process in terms of which the Nats and the ANC in particular were seemingly engaged in a parallel process that would in fact determine both substantive and procedural matters on a bilateral basis and on the basis of private arrangements. So that also sort of tended to sour the air somewhat.
Now, as I mentioned, we're particularly interested in calls for federalism and stronger regional powers, and Nkata was really at the forefront of making these sorts of demands. And I was wondering if I could ask you why you saw federalism as being a really viable and suitable solution for a post-apartheid state.
Well, a number of reasons, I suppose. I mean, there are institutional reasons, in the sense that, you know, large countries, geographically large, I mean, with fairly large populations, with some sort of diversity in them, there is a tendency for them to manage their affairs in a federal, decentralized manner quite successfully, historically. So if one looked at, as we had, if we looked at, you know, governance around the world, federal models of one kind or another. And of course, the F word is a bit problematic as to precisely what you would include within the rubric of federalism. But, you know, just loosely, whatever we understand it to be, was a successful model both both amongst the developed first world and even amongst some of the developing world. So it wasn't as if it was something that was being sucked out of thin air. It was a proven, tried, tested model that succeeded. On the political level as well, one has to remember that we came out of a really, very divided society. And I think there's a recognition of the fact that one of the advantages of federalism over other models is that there's a place in the sun for everyone. And so in a sense, it diffuses political power, and in diffusing it, is more inclusive. So that was a political consideration, which I think remained as valid then as it does now. We also, which I suppose relates to the governance, the first point, but it's a slightly different one, is that we were very conscious very conscious of the fact that a unitary state would tend to be very non-accommodating to alternate policy approaches towards solving problems, and that federalism offered the advantage of different regions, states, whatever the subnational units are, of experimenting and finding the best way forward in terms of addressing our challenges. And that one of the key problems we would have as a country, of course, without the history of governance to address these problems, would be what direction to take at a policy level. So federalism would offer you the advantage of different regions being able to pursue different paths, and then the country would learn from best practice and allow people to, we'd make faster progress, put it that way, than the uniform imposition of a model which may or may not be appropriate, simply coming from one political direction.
Now, one of the things I'm quite interested in is, obviously there were, Inkatha has a very strong regional base, and as a party with a strong regional base advocating a model that was very suitable for your own particular region, how did you respond to demands that this was just, or accusations that this was really sort of a self-interested strategy and not in the national interest or the national best interest?
Well, fortunately, that was easy enough, because we had been consistently pushing this line since the early 70s. Mm-hmm. So if it had suddenly appeared sucked out of thin air the day before the elections, yes, I mean, that, there may have been some substance to it, but that had always been our line. Mm-hmm. And so it was a consistent policy position we'd adopted since at least 73. Well, the party was only formed in 75, but I mean, certainly our leader was advocating that, and as a party, it had always been a sort of basic policy position from day one. Mm-hmm. So that was not a problem. I think the problem that we had was less that, although that was an issue. The problem we had, which was more serious, was that there was an attempt to accuse us, or rather, of being federalist, to accuse us of being secessionist. And so there was a whole propaganda program over a couple of years equating any form of federalism in which the subnational units had any reasonable degree of autonomy, mm-hmm. equating that with secessionist politics. And that was very destructive for us, because it was quite difficult to counter in the prevailing milieu of at the time. And that was problematic, because it was not really an honest attempt to engage with the arguments on their own merits, but rather to try to destroy the argument through attacking the messenger motivation. That was pretty destructive and not very helpful, because at the end of the day, I think if one has regard to what came out of the process, both in the interim constitution and the final constitution, what one sees in the outcome of the negotiations process and what one sees in the manner in which the ruling party in particular put forward certain positions on certain matters, it seems to me, at least, and probably to others, I haven't really spoken about it, but that it was a deliberate attempt to anticipate to counter a line that we had taken a totally different response to. In other words, if we were advocating strong police powers for the subnational units, then they'd come in and have no powers of subnationals, you know, for the provinces, and make it minimal. If we were advocating this, then they'd make sure that the wording and the positions they put forward dealt with it. I mean, one might even argue, it's debatable, I don't know, that had we been silent on certain things, mm-hmm. the Constitution might have been more federal than it is. You know, what I'm trying to say is that the antipathy towards us from that side and the notions that we are secessionists was borne out, I think, also in the nature of the text. One almost sees this sort of overreaction to positions that we were putting forward as a means of negating any future possibility that could come about. You know, centralizing things more than they might have even done.
I see.
But who knows? You know, I mean, that's just conjecture.
Sure.
One just got that impression sometimes as a participant in the process, watching how they reacted to things.
I see. But despite that, I mean, the shape of the South African state has been shaped by some of these discussions.
Absolutely.
Looking back, I mean, are there any things that you feel particularly proud that you were able to
absolutely.
Achieve?
Absolutely. Provinces. There'd be no provinces without us. We would have had a unitary state with local government. Mm-hmm. I mean, provinces are a product of the IFP really having to do some hardcore grandstanding, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I mean, we weren't going to get it. Mm-hmm. The DA and the others, although the DA held similar positions, it wasn't prepared to, you know, go to the edge. We had to play hardball occasionally, and I think the fact that we got provinces is a major achievement. If one looks at all the constitutional principles that were, part of the interim constitution, those principles themselves, which had, of course, to be carried forward through to the new one, although it's debatable to what extent they were sometimes. But anyway, the content of those principles also, some of those, reflects a very strong negotiating position that we took. So, yeah, I think there's a lot. I mean, the actual form of state we have now is not one that we're happy with. It's not adequately right. federal. But to the extent that it's as federal as it is, mm-hmm. I think we can take a large degree of credit for that. And we are proud of that.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to pick up on something you mentioned there. Now, you said the DA or the DP, as it, I guess it was known, similar positions. And, in fact, they probably have a similarly long history going back to the PFP of advocating federalism. Mm. And yet they don't seem to have played nearly as big a role as Nkate did in sort of really bringing this to the forefront. Mm. And I was just wondering if you could comment on, I don't mean for you to speculate about the motivations of other parties, but one might have expected more support from them than you actually perhaps got.
Yeah, I know. It's an interesting point, you know. I really wonder sometimes. Look, I think they were sort of playing gentlemanly, Queensbury rules sort of stuff, you know.
Okay.
And they were content simply to table a paper and speak to it, and that's it. You know, I think we sort of saw it a little bit more seriously in respect of the consequences of one route versus another. Mm-hmm. And for us, in fact, all through the negotiations, even when we started CADESA, the thing on our agenda, number one, was the form of state. Once you agree on the form of state, you can fill in the detail later. But we wanted that basic agreement cemented up front first as a binding commitment to all, and then from that we could put some flesh in it. The ANCC's approach was exactly the opposite, and I think the DA kind of went along with that, pigeonholing things all the time, pigeonhole, and then see what comes out at the end. We were suspicious of that because we suspected that you had this pre-negotiations deal between the Nats and the ANC anyway, and that kind of that dealing behind the back doors, you know, smoke-filled rooms and things, was continuing, and that they would do anything, in fact, to preclude such an agreement being reached first, which was, in fact, what happened. That's why, I suppose, it had to go to the extent it did before we got agreement on the provinces, you know, pretty hardcore stuff, because otherwise we would certainly have ended up with a straight unitary state with local government. I mean, it's black and white.
Right.
Despite the DA, as I say, holding similar views, they would have just gone along with it.
Now, you've mentioned a few times that there was a sort of parallel process going on between the Nats and the ANC. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about about that and how it affected your role in the negotiations, yeah, and what you were able to bring to the table, considering that there were all these suspicions that things were being decided behind closed doors.
Well, look, bear in mind, I'm not speaking as a senior member of the party.
Sure.
I'm just one of the participants, and there were many, and I was a backbencher then and backbencher now, so yeah. I don't want to say I'm speaking for the party in any
sure,
definitive
no,
sense.
But
if you want
that.
My impressions, I mean, one must bear in mind that there had been a long history. Well, no, history is the wrong word. There had been a process, even kick-started with P.W. Botha, of engagement between the Nats and the ANC, you know, mm-hmm. Dakar mm-hmm. Onwards. And this process was obviously secretive even to the ruling party itself at the time, the Nats. I mean, this was an exercise undertaken by the most senior leadership of the National Party to try and to start a process in response to pressure, sure, but to start some sort of process. And in fact, you'll see that's why the State of the Nation last week, Zuma was giving credit to some of those Nats. That process happened. Now, so they developed, I suppose, one level, some sort of understanding. I'm not sure if rapport might be the right word, although sometimes one thinks it was quite close. Rolf Meyer and Ramaphosa, for example, as a duo, seemed to really hit it off. And I think what was happening, they had decided between themselves that this was an exercise, this whole exercise was essentially one between the ANC as the sole representative of the liberation movement and the National Party as the sole representative of everybody else, and that to all intents and purposes, although there would be a public process which was fully inclusive and participatory, in reality it couldn't be sidetracked by people like ourselves, and so they would need to agree on the major milestones and things themselves, which they did. Now, how did it affect us? Well, it affected us in a number of ways, because it affected us in the negotiation process itself, obviously, because if you have that form of collusion and deals being done and they bring it to a table, well, I mean, it's very difficult to undo it. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, as part of the parallel process, was the fact that they were making decisions which are not pertinent to the form of state or, you know, federalism and so on, but to the process, like, you know, how they were dealing with conflicts in the country, agreements on arms and weapons and things of this kind. And there were all sorts of records and Pretoria minutes. There's a whole string of these agreements which effectively legitimized things that the ANC and allies were doing and delegitimized what we were doing in defense of ourselves. So, that, for example, our guys who were defending themselves against an ANC onslaught were prohibited from running around with any traditional weapon at all. But the ANC and any arms caches, you know, obviously were no-go, but the ANC's arms caches were never handed in and never had to be handed in. They had an agreement between themselves, you know, yeah, well, that's fine, we take your word for it, you'll stop shooting us, but no hand your weapons in. Now, that kind of deal, you know, how did it prejudice us? Well, the prejudice, there's a lot of the prejudice was in the form of public opinion, because a lot of the rhetoric of the era was basically painting us as the kind of evil thugs of South African politics, and the knights in shining armor were the other two. And it was very difficult for us to combat that. I mean, we tried. But at the end of the day, I suppose, it's fair to say, we lost the propaganda war. And that had a direct impact on electoral outcomes, because the image of your party is what determines allegiance in large mm-hmm. part. And they were out to demonize us together. And irrespective of the constitutional negotiations themselves, there was that side to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So did this situation, I mean, Nkata is known for taking hard stance during the negotiations and for sort of, one might even term it brinkmanship. And was it this situation that sort of forced you to take these very hard lines in order to have some sort of effect on the outcome?
Look, I'm sure that's part of it. But you know, Daniel, you must also think, in fact, when you introduced yourself and your program, mm-hmm. I can't remember the words you used, mm-hmm. but essentially what we were going through as a country was a sort of once-in-an-opportunity event, mm-hmm. process. These things, you don't do this kind of thing in the normal run of a society, which is, you know, merely minding its own business and getting on with life, mm-hmm. because it takes a crisis to develop a response, you know, to solve these things. So this was a once-off opportunity to negotiate the future of this country, and to simply say, oh, well, we'll let Meyer and Ramaphosa, you know, conclude whatever deals they want with Slovo and put it on the table and we'll say yabas, that wouldn't really end up with a product that was acceptable. So mm-hmm. it was necessary in a way to realize that it was an extraordinary occasion, and if we wanted a lasting outcome that would work and that would prove satisfactory and get the buy-in of everybody, maybe one just had to be a little bit more resolute than one might have been otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Yeah. But also, look, I think to be fair, bear in mind that as a party, our members had been under attack for some years. Right. I mean, there had been years of a physical onslaught of mm-hmm. people being killed left, right, and center. There's a quasi-civil war going on. And I don't think, you know, that, I don't think it was expected of ourselves, that we expected of ourselves to suddenly become meek and mild sheep simply because now we're talking mm-hmm. instead of, you know, I mean, if you're having to defend yourself with guns because you're being shot at all the time, you don't suddenly become lamb in the negotiations. So, but at the end of the day, you know, I mean, I think it was PAC that made the point, and it's a valid point. It was valid to a point, in fact. Their point was, you only get at the negotiation table what you gain on the battlefield, which is why they got nothing. But I think, in fact, we got a lot more mm-hmm. out of it mm-hmm. than that statement would normally attribute to parties and other situations. So, we played beyond our... punch beyond our weight, perhaps, to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned the violence that was going on at the time, and of course there was a lot of propaganda and misinformation flying around mm-hmm. about that. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how that affected the negotiation process.
Well, it resulted in being closed down at one point.
Right.
I mean,
right.
This is the whole point. I mean, what can I say? I mean, the whole thing was just such a sham, in which accusations were made with absolutely no regard for the truth, mm-hmm. and the media were willing bedfellows in this whole process. You know, I mean, you had a crossroads situation, but just days before you had a Zonke Sizwe, where events happened that were completely ignored. Mm-hmm. And yet one was a retaliation for the other. Mm-hmm. You know, people came down, they killed a whole lot of Zulu migrants. A couple of days later, they got up, they went back and they clobbered them back, and then suddenly the whole negotiations came to a halt because our guys were destabilizing things. Mm-hmm. You know, all the violence in the trains was attributed to Third Force, but inverted right. commas, right. Inkatha. You know, everything right. was Inkatha and Third Force. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it's a myth. Of course it's a myth. There certainly might have been individuals within the security forces who were working with individual IFP, but the same way they were also working with ANCs. I mean, they're working with everybody. What their agenda was, God knows. Yeah. But at the end of the day, the victims of all that in respect of perceptions were ourselves. So, yeah, those were not good times.
Fair enough. One of the questions I wanted to ask you was, there was a recent article in... Business Day by Tony Leon on the F word. I'm not sure if you saw it, but he mentioned Inkatha's strong stand during the negotiations, but also how one of the things that was also on Inkatha's agenda was the role of the king. And he referred to this issue now, you know, 20 years, let's say, after the fact, as being somewhat remote and obscure to think that it was of such high importance then. And I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about the why this became such an important issue for you, the representation and the role of the Zulu monarchy.
You know, I'm not sure I'm the right person to speak to this matter.
Okay.
I mean, I'll give a comment, but I don't know that I'm... I think others would give you a better answer. Mm-hmm. But I think it's part of the form of state issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, the question arises, are we actually even a republic? At one level, we're a hybrid because... the constitution allows for provincial constitutions to make provisions which are in a sense, a sort of, but at odds with a normal standard republican form of state. You know, one can make position for a Zulu monarch, for example. Although, again, that would only be a constitutional position, not an executive monarch. Mm-hmm. So, but again, you know, it's something that we were keen to do. Look, I think it's part of what the IFP was about then. It was there's a long history to it and to the role of the party and its leadership in the protection of the rights of traditional leaders. I think there's also a strong fear that the ANC was so against any form of traditionalism, culture, traditional culture, and so on, that it would do everything it could to obliterate the entire institution. And certainly some of the rhetoric before the negotiations was pretty hardcore. And so, in a sense, this was a reaction to that. If one looks at the protection that we actually got in the constitution, it went quite far. Unfortunately, we couldn't quite get as far as we wanted it to go, and so the constitution has not served as the protector of the institution of traditional leadership in the manner that we had hoped it would. The wording was such that effectively legislation could recognize traditional leadership but not really give it the kind of powers that it had. And so there has been a process of withering away the role of traditional leaders right from 93 until now, and it's an ongoing process. It's matched on the other side by this kind of showmanship stuff where they give them powers, technically they give them powers to do things they've always done anyway, but they're taking away the core substance of governance. So we've lost that one. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason why it was important for us from the beginning, because we always recognized that we wanted, you know, this is, South Africa was a bit of a unique country. It's sort of, I think we saw it institutionally as almost a dual system, you know, Western in one way and African in another. And we were trying to craft, you know, institutional arrangements that would recognize that. And the king and the kingdom was all part of that process of carving out a special place for the what was African in a Western constitution.
I see. Fair enough. Yeah, makes sense. A question I had was about the elections, because I mean, until a very late stage, it seemed as if the IFP would not participate, and it was, you know, about two weeks before, I think, that decision was reversed. And I was wondering if, from your perspective, you could comment on why that happened. You know, why the party decided to participate.
Yes. I was actually on the election committee at the time, and we were told to stop work. I remember. It's quite interesting.
Told to stop work on?
Well, preparing for elections. We had an election committee, which had been established beforehand, and I was serving on that body.
Yeah.
And then the instructions came through, right, and that's it. We're out of the elections, stop, cease all work.
Sure.
Which we did, yeah. Look, I mean, it was a reaction to the way the entire negotiations process had been going. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's exactly what we're saying. You know, these agreements between the Nats and the ANC and the way they're dragooning people along and the lack of inclusivity and this pigeonholing things to retrieve later in a way that suits themselves. I mean, all this kind of thing. I think we realized that it was a democratic decision. We could choose to participate or not participate. Nobody forces you to participate in something. You're invited to participate, and you choose to do so. So we went as far as we wanted to. We saw the futility of proceeding any further. Mm. And so we elected not to go any further. The fact that they responded to it in a particular way, and that at the end there was an agreement to make certain arrangements that would allow us to participate, such as the dual ballot. Of course, that was another one of the achievements that we managed to achieve. Well, obviously, it's a good thing. In hindsight, it's a good thing. But we were serious. And I suppose they realized we were serious. And that's, I think, what you were referring to earlier when you talked about bit of brinkmanship or hard. What did you call, what word did you use? I can't remember what word you used.
Brinkmanship.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, whatever it was, it achieved a positive outcome.
Now, if I can just go back to the federal issue, and I'm keeping an eye on the time. You mentioned that despite being quite proud of the accomplishments of actually having provinces, the shape of the South African state is not all that you would desire. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the shortcomings of the state today.
Well, I mean, I suppose if one you've got to compare what we have constitutionally. Mm-hmm. With what we wanted, but also compare what we have in reality with what we have constitutionally, because even now there's a disjunction between those two. Mm-hmm. What we wanted, I suppose, was a more classic form of federalism where the residual powers were located with the states and the central national government would be have a listed set of functions. We believe the residual powers with the states would result in a far stronger form of federalism. Of course, we've got the converse of that. Mm-hmm. That's one problem. Second problem is that having lost that battle and had a system where the residual powers were with the center and the states, the provinces, had listed powers, then you say, okay, let's look at the content of those listed powers, the basket of powers and functions, and see whether they are acceptable. And the answer is in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. Yes, in the sense that we derived a system of overrides, and the overrides technically favor the provinces, insofar as if there is competing national legislation, it has to satisfy certain criteria before it can override provincial law. Two problems arise. So that's great for us. That was a major accomplishment as well, and we were very happy with that. But then the two problems arise are the following. A, the range of functional areas was limited. Sometimes very severely. I mean, things like police were limited to really, you may as well take it away completely, actually, not even have it there. You know, some areas which should be strongly located in the subnational units were taken away effectively, such as policing. And on the other major weakness was that in reality, despite the legislative powers that the provinces were given, they lacked the ability to raise the funds to match those functions. So because all funds were raised nationally and then allocated to provinces in terms of a formula, and because the formula dictated that the vast bulk of that money go on the key service, you know, social welfare, education and health, there's virtually nothing left for anything else. So even if you had the legislative power to legislate on a range of other matters, you could pass millions of laws, but you didn't have the budget to implement them, and you couldn't raise the money. So it became a bit of a pyrrhic victory in some ways. So that's why I'm saying that the form is there, but the outcome lacked certain things. I must say the overrides was a major issue in our favor. But then it gets to the second problem, which I'm saying there's a disjuncture between what we actually have and constitutionally, and what provinces do. The reality is that provinces have far more powers now to do A, B, and C than they're in fact exercising. They're not exercising what they have to the extent that they could. Part of the reason for that is this issue of budget. Because if you legislate for something that requires finances and you haven't got the money, then you've got a bit of a problem. But nonetheless, I do feel personally that the provinces have been tardy generally in exercising the kind of legislative functions that they have, and they've tended to be reactive than proactive, mm-hmm. and not to take the lead in matters that they could. Now there are exceptions, there are cases of provincial legislation when they've done X, Y, and Z, and it's fine, mm-hmm. but by and large they haven't exercised the scope as much as they could have done.
Well, I think that comes to the end of the questions I had, and I'm conscious you've got other places to be in.
That's fine. It's just the budget at 2 o'clock.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, then in that case, one more question.
Right.
So, just with the current debate, that I understand there's currently a move to sort of reevaluate or look at the provinces, and there are calls to have them abolished and these sorts of things. What is going to your position on or Nkata's position on that? How will you respond to the current challenges to the sort of real existence of the provinces?
Look, at one level, we've been fairly consistent in saying that unless provinces have meaningful powers, then there's no point in their existing. So, in one way, if as a result of this review process, provinces are emasculated beyond what they are already, then we may well adopt a view. We haven't yet done so, but we may well adopt the view, then look, why bother? You're just doing this as a pro forma exercise, and they're a name, but they don't have anything substantive to do other than administrative things. We'll just have a governor or something and shut down the provincial legislatures. We haven't taken that view yet, partly because the process, that's an interesting process, actually. The process has been one of government asking a set of questions pertaining to both to local government and to provinces, and then it's evaluated those responses. But this process has been over some 3 years now, and it still hasn't come out with its response to those issues. Okay. So we're eagerly awaiting government's response. We don't know what it is. There are hints here and there of this and that. I mean, there's talk, for example, about reviewing the schedules. So now reviewing the schedules can mean weakening the functional areas, diminishing the number of functional areas, or could mean strengthening. It doesn't necessarily mean weakening. Of course, we could be suspicious, as we are, of their motives and of what's intended. But against this, you see, one has to also bear in mind that one of the things that, it's not inviolate, but nonetheless, there's a certain sense one has that when we won the issue of provinces on provinces, this is why I said to you, this is a major, it was a crossroads issue where what you achieved then maybe lost perpetuity, but for some time into the future, and that's not the kind of thing you can normally engage in the normal course of events for the state's governance. So we thought that once you have the provinces created, it generates a momentum of its own. They assume a life of their own, they're there, there are power bases in the country, even within the ruling party the power is spread, there are provincial powers, all sorts of things happen, and that it then becomes very difficult down the road to undo that. Now, I think that's partly where the ruling party is now. There's a strong component of it which rues the day that it gave in to us on that issue and is now having to try to undo what it doesn't want. And another strong component which says, no, it's nothing to do with the IFP, we've got it, it's good, it's fine, let's make it work. Now, I don't know how they've resolved it internally themselves, but it hasn't yet reached the level of a formal position being tabled by government. So we don't know, you know, what they're saying. I mean, they give hints, you know, they want to do this, want to do that, want to do the other. But the hints are merely that.
Okay, excellent. Well, certainly be interesting to follow this. And see,
I suspect they'll want to weaken the provinces, I suspect. Yeah. I mean, it seems fairly obvious. But then, you know, they have major challenges also of local government. Mm-hmm. And the question is, you know, if you weaken the provinces, what do you do? Do you take it away from the province and give it to the local, or you take it away from the province and give it to the national, or what? I speak to some ANC guys who think they should strengthen the provinces, because the local government is the big problem in this country, not the provinces. Local government's screwing up completely. It's a disaster. And one of the solutions is to strengthen the capacity of provincial governments to do their job properly. Then the things won't go wrong down at the bottom as much. Right. So, you know, we don't know.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. It's been very interesting, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, pleasure, Dan. No problem.